Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The groundbreaking technologies that we will be using tomorrow are being developed in labs around the world today. From tech innovations having to do with our travel beyond Earth into space, to giant experimental power plants, to new ways to build things and experience the world, right down to tech focusing on the human body and our brain. My guest today is Zach Wienersmith. In their book, Zach, together with his wife, Kelly Wienersmith, tackle the question, what will the world of tomorrow be like? Soonish is the title of the book. Soonish, 10 emerging technologies that'll improve and or ruin everything. He's a writer, illustrator, and a cartoonist. He's known for his work in the award-winning webcomic Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. His wife is a researcher, Kelly, a faculty member in the bioscience department at Rice University, where she studies parasites that manipulate the behavior of their hosts. This was a best book of the year voted by the Wall Street Journal, also Popular Science in 2017. It's now out in paperback. Zach Wienersmith, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
This is a really fascinating book. The way you teamed up with your wife, who is a bioscience researcher, and your clever cartoons fitting into this theme, offering the promise but often the worries of these new technologies. You start off the book, before we get to some of these examples here, you start off the book by writing about how predicting the future is really hard and how in the past very learned people have not done a very good job of predicting what technologies will catch on in the future. Talk about that, first of all.
Yeah, so the problem with predicting the future is anything worth predicting is too hard to predict. So, for example, I could make a very impressive prediction today and say, in the future, computers will be faster and cheaper, and solar panels will be more efficient, and there will be a greater diversity of types of potato chips. All that stuff is obvious. In fact, if you gave a five-year-old a graph of, say, computer speed over time and just said extend the graph, I think they could do it. And it would be about as accurate as anybody else. The hard stuff to predict is well, I can't predict it, because it's often contingent. So one thing we talk about in the book is how in the 19th century, for scientific reasons, people were trying to see if they could liquefy gases. And this was a race set up kind of by an accidental discovery by Faraday that when you confine gas in a little container, it liquefies. Which, you know, we're sort of used to the idea now that you can liquefy a gas. But back then, it's sort of like a miracle. It's like condensing nothingness into a liquid. Mm-hmm. And so there was this race to condense gases by freezing them. It turned out to be easier to freeze them than to pressurize them. Anyway, long story short, that freezing leads to the ability to supercool metals, which results in this strange property people hadn't predicted called superconducting, which allows you to make super powerful magnets, which we can use to scan brains. So you can see how it's a bit of a tortured route. So Faraday, when he was looking at, I believe it was carbon dioxide in liquid form, certainly didn't say to himself, I wonder if we could scan brains with this. Mm. The path forward was very meandering, and actually I think that's typical for technologies. So, you know, you have to be careful predicting the future. If you, like me, enjoy Golden Age science fiction, you'll notice they have extremely advanced androids and spaceships. But then there's all this weird anachronistic stuff, like they don't have very good computers somehow, despite having androids. And then they also underestimate social changes. So, you know, if you read a Heinlein novel, they have robots that can do everything, but for some reason the women still do all the cooking.
Right.
So I think humans are just really bad at predicting the future of anything that's not straightforward.
Right.
Even so, we don't try to.
Right. Even, Zach, even when it is straightforward, here's a quote from Thomas Edison, of all people, an inventor, about the medium we're using right now, radio. Quote, the radio craze will die out in time. That was in 1922. H.G. Wells, the British writer and historian, here's a quote about radio. I am reported to be pessimistic about broadcasting. The truth is that I have anticipated its complete disappearance, confident that the unfortunate people who must now subdue themselves to listening in will soon find a better pastime for their leisure. H.G. Wells. So we really don't see the future right when it's staring us in the face, do we?
No, you know, Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize economist, infamously in the 90s predicted the internet was a sort of fad. So I guess we've not gotten any better either.
Right. Let's talk about some of the fascinating technologies, the 10 emerging technologies. We'll just touch on a few of them here in this conversation. 10 emerging technologies that will improve and or ruin everything. Let's go into space. Space elevators, they are featured on the cover of this book. We've had a lot of talk about going to Mars, about returning to the moon. The Chinese recently sent a probe to the moon. What are space elevators? How would they work?
Right. So to give a little context, you know, it's very expensive to go to space. I think we calculated to send one apple seed to space costs about $10. It's not cheap. And the main reason is that if you look at a rocket on the pad, it's about the size of a skyscraper, but it's a skyscraper that's 80% made of propellant that just gets burned on the way up. Actually, if you look at the old Apollo ships that went to the moon, it's only about 1.5% of them was the stuff that was actually going to orbit the moon. And so it's just, as an analogy, if you imagine you had to drive from Alaska to Florida with no gas stations in between, you can imagine right at the beginning you'd have to carry a huge amount of gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the gasoline you're using is going to carry more gasoline, not to cargo. You'd have to just bring a little cargo with you. And so with a space elevator, so you can imagine for that trip from Alaska to Florida, the ideal way to travel would be to have a magic pixie who drops a drop of gasoline in your tank right when you need it. So you're never using energy to pull fuel that you're going to use later. You're always just pulling cargo and your vehicle. So a space elevator, so to speak, is the magic pixie version of going to space. You have a huge cable that extends from the surface of the Earth for a couple of reasons, maybe from the ocean of the Earth. But anyway, from the surface of the Earth out to a huge rock or heavy object out in space. And there's just this huge cable. And you have a little rider on it, a little capsule that rides up like an elevator riding up in a building, only the building is 10,000 or 100,000 kilometers tall. And the reason you do this is you don't have to carry fuel with you. So it's far more efficient, and you can actually go all the way out to where gravity doesn't affect you very much, and then you can just zip off into space. And the thought is this could reduce the cost of space travel by 95 to 99%, which is pretty good. The problem is what we call the middle part, that 100,000-kilometer-long cable. You need a pretty good cable. You need to have a lot of what's called specific strength, which just means it's very strong and very light. Strong in the sense that something can thwack it and it doesn't break, and that, you know, when it's just stretched between Earth and space, it doesn't pull itself apart. And there are a couple of candidate materials, but we're just starting to be able to make them. So it physics permits it, so it'll probably happen eventually, but whether it'll happen in our lifetime is a different matter.
Let's talk about robotic construction. This is an interesting concept that you delve into with this book. You look into the possibility of robot-made housing, and I was surprised to see that you trace this back to, I mean, some of its origins back to Thomas Edison in the early 1900s, mm-hmm. but also the Germans in the 1940s with a concept you name in the book called Hausbaumaschine, a house-building factory on train tracks. So this has been a dream that may someday come true, unless it's a nightmare, right?
Yes, so houses are kind of interesting as a modern thing. So if you look around the room you're sitting in, or maybe the car you're in while you're listening to this, almost everything you look at was made on a factory line, you know, whether it's a pencil or a part of your car or your curtains. And the reason we do that is just everyone knows economies of scale make things cheaper. A house is one of the few things where you still have a bunch of people come out and check the location and make it specific to the place. Of course, we have had advances. They're prefabricated parts, and those have gotten better and better and better. And we now even have it so prefab parts can generate some diversity. The suburbs don't look quite as similar house to house as they used to. So there have been some advances. But there's this idea that you could have a machine that basically just builds the house or builds extensions on a house, just does any kind of construction, including tall buildings, that sort of thing. And you could do it one. The most fun idea is to build a sort of giant 3D printer that extrudes concrete-like material instead of, you know, plastic. But you can also have a robot that basically behaves like a construction worker, only it works all night and doesn't charge extra for overtime. So really cool possibilities. Some danger of job loss, but that's a separate matter.
How close are we to doing that? What did your research tell you there?
we've already got some rudimentary versions of some of this stuff. So there's a robot called Sam that's the semi-automated mason. And Sam basically does what you'd imagine. He lays down bricks, or maybe she, I don't know. Lays down bricks, slaps on mortar, lays down more bricks. So you can imagine, so to speak, any job on a construction site that's sort of repetitive and simple, you can teach a robot to do. There's a lot more complicated stuff that we don't know how to teach robots to do, or don't know how to teach them to do it cheaper than just hiring a construction worker who knows what he's doing. So some of it's already happening. Some of the more complicated stuff will take time. Not everything is easy for a robot.
I suppose we can look at, you know, your example of the car, how those car assembly lines have become so automated, fewer people involved, more machines doing repetitive work there that they're programmed to do. So I suppose that's one of the more easily imaginable things you have in this book. If you just joined us, my guest this half hour, writer, illustrator, cartoonist, Zach Wienersmith, known for his work in Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. Perhaps you're a fan of that. I am certainly a fan of it. It's an award-winning web cartoon. Soonish is the name of the book. 10 emerging technologies that will improve and or ruin everything. What I might want to ask you is probably something where the strength lies with your co-author here, your wife, Kelly. But I want to ask you about synthetic biology. What is synthetic biology, and where are we now with it?
Yeah, so synthetic biology is basically making life to order. So you can imagine, just to give a random example, suppose there were an organism where you drop in some food for it, like a bacteria, and you drop in food and it spits out gasoline. That would be quite valuable. As far as we know, it doesn't exist because there's no reason in regular life to evolve the means to generate gasoline. It's just something humans want. But so with some technology that's really just recently come into existence, it's possible you could program, so to speak, a bacterium or some sort of microbe to make whatever you want. In fact, there are people already working on a machine that can make a form of life that could generate a precursor to jet fuel. But there's other stuff. You know, a lot of medical molecules, medicines, involve extremely complicated molecules. And so the chemical processes to make them are really difficult. But we've already got these little nanomachines called bacteria. So if we could just convince them to do stuff we want, it could be really quite valuable.
And programming bacteria, for instance, to detect cancer.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So, bacteria can take information into their memory bank, so to speak, via their own DNA, right? The DNA is kind of like this little library in the nucleus of a cell. And if you could put information into it, you can get that information out. So you could imagine you could make bacteria whose deal is they go on a little magic journey through your innards, and then when they emerge, you collect some of them and see if in their DNA there's some signal left over from that journey. And it turns out, and we talk about this a bit in our precision medicine chapter, all sorts of diseases, from heart disease to all sorts of cancers, can leave signatures that are detectable but subtle. So potentially we can program bacteria to basically be little nanobots without us having to actually construct the nanobots.
Zach, talk a little bit about your work in this book as a cartoonist. Many hilarious panes here. Some are single pane, some are multi-pane cartoons here. I guess to match up what we were just talking about, maybe synthetic biology. On one page, you have a farmer with a pitchfork proclaiming, "Someday we will have cabbages so large and so varied that everyone's children will be disappointed at dinner."
Yeah, we will. So my real job most of the time is drawing cartoons that just tell jokes about nerd stuff. But the thought was, one, I think maybe readers expect it from me at this point, but also I think there's maybe an element. This book has a lot of jokes in it, but we really did do a lot of research, and we called a lot of experts. We tried to really understand the subject matter, and also it helps when your wife is a scientist.
Yeah.
So there's a decent amount of depth. There are a couple places where I can imagine a reader would say, okay, this is a little tough to understand. And the thought was, if we could throw in some humor, it maybe takes the edge off of it. Because I think fundamentally part of learning is about not being scared of the topic. So if you throw in a few jokes, maybe people relax and they realize, hey, you're really understanding the basics of how DNA works. It's not that complicated. So if people can just chill out and enjoy themselves, hopefully that helps them learn the topic.
Mm-hmm. When you look at cartoons in this book or others, I mean, it seems like a lot of them play off of our concerns or, of course, exaggerating mm-hmm. our concerns here. Do you have a patented way in which you approach humor in this type of situation?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. If I did, I probably wouldn't tell you.
That's right.
But No, I mostly just try to read a lot and you know, think about things hopefully other people aren't thinking about. Reading about technology helps, especially futuristic technology, because there are so many ominous possibilities. You know, we talked about space travel. Well, one thing that happens if you have cheap access to space is you have cheap access to dropping heavy things from space. So there are a lot of, like, interesting, almost every technology comes with its very own doomsday scenario. Which is, of course, an opportunity to tell jokes about it.
Mm-hmm. So when you came up with the doomsday scenarios, because it's very nice with these 10 emerging technologies in this book, you talk about what the technology is, whether it's bioprinting or synthetic biology or robotic construction of houses, what it is, where it is right now, the challenges to its realization, but the ways it could make everything good but also terrible. Did you and Kelly sit around saying, okay, so given robotic construction or space, what's our doomsday scenario, right?
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think one thing we're trying to fight against is uninformed optimism. We're optimistic people, but you should be a bit skeptical so you don't get taken in by nonsense. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there is, as you mentioned, robotic construction, there is a legitimate concern. Something like 7%, I want to say, I don't have the numbers offhand, but a large percent of people work in or around construction. And so if we replace them, we've replaced a pretty good middle-class job that doesn't require a college degree for most positions. So that's not exactly doomsday compared to, like, dropping asteroids from space, but it's pretty bad for a lot of people potentially. Mm-hmm. So we did try to talk about that and try to, you know, just be clear about it, not delight it for the benefit of people who want to be excited about the future.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about bioprinting, an evolving technology you have there. And a nice line there, like the 3D printing of body organs. Why stop at 7 margaritas when you can just print a new liver?
Yes. I should say that there's actually, even if we could 3D print you a new organ, there's a good reason not to have 7 margaritas
night.
probably right. A couple of good reasons.
So where are we in recreating organs that may wear out in our bodies?
So we're still at early stages. We can do some. There's a company called Organovo that can do thin body parts. So you can imagine if you want to replace a cornea, it's a much easier task than say replacing lungs. And the reason is if you want to replace a liver, you know, if you look at a liver, it just looks kind of like a blobby thing. But actually, it's a really complicated machine. And one thing it's filled with is vasculature. You know, veins that branch into smaller veins, eventually branch into these little tiny capillaries that deliver blood all over the liver. So if you dissolved out everything but the capillaries, you'd still be able to make out the shape of the liver. And so how in the world do we as humans build these things? Well, we talked to a guy named Jordan Miller at Rice University, and they came up with this really clever method where essentially you So to speak, you use a melting laser to make a shape like veins out of sugar, almost like rock candy. And then what you do is you spray vein cells around it, and then it forms into veins. And it turns out once you have those, they will bud their own capillaries. Hmm. So that's a cool step forward. I mean, obviously, there's still a lot to do. But we are moving forward. I think plausibly within our lifetimes, you could have a machine that puts out organs of replacement, which would not only save a lot of lives, but improve a lot of lives for people who have to wait for transplants right now.
Mm-hmm. In researching and writing this book with your wife, what surprised you the most? Was it a technology that you went into and your eyes were really open to the possibilities?
I would say just about everything kind of threw us for a loop a little bit. The chapter on brain-computer interfaces, you know, just interfacing your brain with a computer, was kind of remarkable because there's already progress on it that's genuinely creepy. It's already possible to detect, for instance, lack of focus using simple brain scanners. So what's funny is we actually read in one book a guy proposing this is a sort of good thing for the workplace. You can imagine you're an office worker and you're just checking Facebook for a minute and your boss is like, hey, our brain scanner just detected that. You better get back to your spreadsheet. So that's the dystopian version. There is a less awful sounding version where suppose you have a surgeon who's operating on you. You maybe want a machine that tells them when they're drifting a little. So in general, as we open up the brain to computers, a lot of really dystopian possibilities present themselves. So that was really interesting to research.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite emerging technology among these?
Oh, space travel. We're giant space dorks over here. It's funny. We're both cowards, though. Neither of us would like to go to the moon because it's too scary. But we'd love for it to be possible for brave people to do it.
I like your illustration where it's sort of an introduction to you and the co-author, your wife. It says in the pane, "Your authors," and then Kelly is saying in her comic book figure is saying, "Yeah, well, in my 20s, I finished part of an advanced degree," and you, Zach, have the quote bubble saying, "I drew a lot of jokes about wieners."
that's an apt description of our roles in life.
What's next in your life, Zach, for those who are fans of your illustrations and your writing? What can we look forward to?
Well, I'm continuing to draw comics. I have another book coming out. I'm afraid it's a bit controversial. It's a book on immigration policy with an economist named Brian Kaplan proposing a more open immigration framework. It's a little outside my wheelhouse, but I promise I'll get back to science jokes immediately afterwards.
Okay, but also featuring your illustrations, your cartoons?
Yep. I'm the illustrator for that book, Jeff.
Okay, excellent. We'll look forward to that. My guest this half hour has been writer, illustrator, cartoonist Zach Wiener-Smith, known, of course, for his award-winning web comic Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. Soonish is the book that he's written together with his wife, who's a bioscience researcher. Soonish, 10 emerging technologies that'll improve and or ruin everything. Zach, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That winds up the show for today. By the way, River to River is, of course, available as a podcast. You just subscribe to River to River using your favorite podcast app. Go to iowapublicradio.org or download our IPR app. It's a good way not to miss River to River and to share conversations you hear on this program with other people. River to River is produced by Rick Brewer and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.